You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Despite Moscow's hollow denials, it is now clear that Russian troops and equipment have illegally crossed the border into eastern and southeastern Ukraine.
Russia is either invading Ukraine or Russia has issued an awful lot of its troops with faulty compasses. I'll be discussing that and the day's other top stories with The Independent's Mary Dajewski and Jane Kinnenmont from Chatham House. Also ahead, we'll be checking in with our correspondent in Bogota and find out what happens when you borrow a country's national treasures and the return address changes. And finally...
Isn't it amazing how life is one thing and then in an instant it becomes something else? Like here I am, Mia, the girl who thinks about the cello and Adam, and just like that.
We'll be reviewing the latest movie releases with Karen Krasanovich. That's all coming up right now on Monocle 24. Lots coming up then in the next 60 minutes or so here on Midori House. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
Ukraine has today called for full membership of NATO, its strongest plea yet for Western military help, after accusing Russia of sending in armoured columns that have routed its troops on behalf of pro-Moscow rebels. The Russian President Vladimir Putin, defiant as ever, compared Kiev's drive to regain control of its rebellious eastern cities to the Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union in the Second World War. NATO has accused Russia of a blatant violation of Ukraine's sovereignty. Russia denies its forces have crossed the border, but Monocle's Brussels correspondent Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson says NATO's satellite images clearly show around 1,000 troops crossing into Ukraine.
Secretary General Rasmussen was very strong in his condemnation of Russian invasion of Ukrainian territory, of their sovereignty, and he confirmed that the Russian military presence was there, again backing up what NATO said yesterday, and with the satellite images of 1,000 troops.
The UN says almost 2,600 people, including civilians, have died in fighting in eastern Ukraine since the fighting started in mid-April. President Obama said that Russia would continue to suffer economically from its military involvement in Ukraine.
As a result of the actions Russia has already taken and the major sanctions we've imposed with our European and international partners, Russia is already more isolated than at any time since the end of the Cold War. Capital is fleeing. Investors are increasingly staying out. Its economy is in decline. This ongoing Russian incursion into Ukraine will only bring more costs and consequences for Russia.
Senegal has become West Africa's fifth country to confirm a case of Ebola on Friday after a student arriving from neighbouring Guinea carrying the disease. Health Minister Awa Marie Kolsek said the young man was treated at a hospital in the Senegalese capital Dakar but concealed that he'd had close contact with Ebola victims in his home country. The current outbreak, which began in Guinea, has killed more than 1,500 people across the region. Brazil's GDP fell 0.6% in the second quarter this year, reported National Statistics Agency IBGE on Friday. The news means that the country suffered a recession in the first half of the year as investment plunged and the country's hosting of the World Cup suffocated economic activity. Latin America's largest economy has suffered stagnant growth for more than 3 years under President Dilma Rousseff's left-leaning policies, which have dented consumer and business confidence and caused heavy losses for financial investors. Here, the British Prime Minister has claimed much of Scottish industry and more than a million jobs could be in jeopardy if the country votes next month to leave the United Kingdom. 3 weeks before the independence referendum, David Cameron travelled to Glasgow to state his case. The economic impact of the vote has dominated the debate.
If we make foreigners of our neighbours, business could become tougher, trade could become more costly and complex, jobs could become harder to find. So my case is this. Our single market is one of our union's greatest advantages. If we stay together, Scottish businesses have better opportunities, Scottish consumers have more choice, Scottish people have more secure jobs. Why put all those great advantages at risk by going into the great unknown?
And finally, two Australian farmers say they may have found the world's woolliest sheep, whose estimated 25-kilogram coat, if confirmed, could shatter the world record currently held by neighbouring New Zealand. Shaun the sheep was found wandering near the town of Oatlands, some 52 miles from Hobart, the capital of Tasmania. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 1806 here in London, which will be 1306 in New York. And joining me here in the studio with their take on today's news are Mary Dajewski, Chief Editorial Writer and Columnist at The Independent, and Jane Killenmont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House. We will start once again in Ukraine, this year's apparent preferred holiday destination for the Russian military. Vladimir Putin continues to deny that Russia is invading Ukraine, while kind of suggesting that it would be okay if Russia was, because Ukraine is behaving like Nazi Germany, so there. He has also made crashingly unsubtle reference to Russia's ambitions in the Arctic and reminded everybody that they have nuclear weapons. Ukraine's Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, meanwhile, has announced that Ukraine will seek NATO membership. Hard to imagine that ending badly. Mary, I'll ask you first a question I think I've asked you before. Does Vladimir Putin actually care that nobody believes him?
I think his domestic audience believes him, and at the moment that's his prime concern. So the fact that what he is saying is so widely disbelieved abroad, and indeed has been called by several American officials plain lying, I don't think it bothers him too much so long as he's got the domestic audience.
But do you think Russians listening to the news are buying this wholeheartedly? They really think that Russia is not invading Ukraine?
It's not only that they think that Russia is not invading Ukraine, but they think that, in fact, it might be better if they were. And that is, of course, a huge problem both for Western officials and for Western public opinion, because there is this huge mismatch of perception.
Jane, to bring you in, are we getting any sense yet? Because this is something that I have failed to understand. Pretty much since they annexed Crimea, that made a certain amount of logical sense. But I can't get any sense now of what Vladimir Putin's idea of victory looks like. I don't see where he's going with this.
Russia may be taken by surprise by the strength of the resistance that Ukraine has managed to put up so far. I think when Crimea was first annexed, my colleagues who understand Ukraine much better than I do say that the Ukrainian government was in a state of total shock and disarray, that the new interim government didn't have many security professionals. Russia probably expected them to respond pretty weakly, but they have actually made some progress and some gains. So Russia may now be trying to figure out what to do next.
Mary, you mentioned domestic considerations there, but the obvious and I guess driving domestic consideration is going to end up being Russia's economy, which is not doing terrifically well. The ruble is down to an all-time low against the dollar this morning. In the last few minutes, David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, has talked about booting Russia out of the SWIFT international banking transaction system. How much more of this can Russia's economy stand?
Well, the interesting thing is that, or at least one of the interesting things, is that there have been reports over the last couple of weeks that there's some degree of dissension in the Kremlin and that there is opposition to current policy from oligarchs of a sort of pro-Western or Western trading disposition who are extremely unhappy with the prospect that things might get actually worse. The problem for Putin is that the expectations of, as it were, ordinary Russians and his base in public opinion is really the opposite. They couldn't care less because they don't actually see from day to day. The fact that the ruble is weaker means nothing to them at all. Most Russians are not the Russians that you see in London and New York. Most Russians are living in the provinces. They're living on relatively low salaries. And so far, they've never had it so good. So their perception is completely different.
Jane, I wanted to bring up this other point that got raised today by Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who has announced that Ukraine will seek membership of NATO. Is that actually likely? Because if NATO had decided to admit Ukraine now, I realise that's probably not that easy. They would be buying World War III, wouldn't they?
Well, it could certainly aggravate the situation, and I doubt that the US, under Obama in particular, has got much appetite for this.
Mary, as well, it also strikes me that at least, I mean, it was widely sort of at least figured that one of the reasons for Vladimir Putin's adventure in Georgia a few years ago was to keep Georgia out of NATO, and it was widely surmised that his adventure in Ukraine was to keep Ukraine out of the EU. Is there any chance that this is ever going to happen, Ukraine becoming a member of NATO?
Well, I think the thing is that it doesn't really depend on Ukraine. The timing of the Ukrainian Prime Minister's announcement today is all connected with next week's NATO summit in Wales, where Ukraine will obviously be very high on the agenda. And the Ukrainians want it to be known that they have ambitions to join NATO. But of course, it doesn't depend entirely on them. And in fact, in some ways, the more enthusiastic they are about joining NATO, the less realistic it is. The Western members of NATO have really had it up to here for a long time with ambitions of people who've really got no hope of actually meeting the NATO requirements. They can't afford any more passengers in NATO, really, than they've already got. Any people who are not prepared to pay, as it were, the subscription charge and to meet the standards of weaponry and general training. And there is no way that Kyiv can do that for a very, very long time.
I mean, as you say, NATO is meeting in Cardiff next week, and as you're quite right in saying, Ukraine will be top of the agenda. But Jane Kinnaman, I'll ask you again, that everybody, I mean, it's painfully obvious to everybody that there is no appetite for military confrontation with Russia. President Obama has said as much explicitly. Absent that, what deterrents against Russia are still available? Is there anybody or anything that can stop Russia doing as it likes in Ukraine?
This is where why the focus is on economic pressure and on sanctions. We've just heard Obama saying Russia's more economically isolated than at any time since the end of the Cold War. He would probably argue that it was economic pressure at the end of the day that brought Iran to the negotiating table rather than the threat of war. But he'll be desperately hoping that this can influence Putin through the oligarchs.
Well, on that, let's move on to Syria, where the long wait for an even slightly encouraging development continues. The UN has released a series of astonishing statistics over the last week or so. 191,000 dead since March 2011, 3 million refugees abroad, 6.5 million internally displaced out of a pre-war population of 22 million people. Yet another massacre more recently has been attributed to the Islamic State, this time of 150 Syrian soldiers, and another Syrian group has captured 43 UN peacekeepers on the Golan Heights. Jane, I'll ask you first. Hindsight is obviously a wonderful and yet entirely useless thing, but is it now arguable that not getting into Syria early was a mistake as far as the West was concerned?
It's not clear that Western airstrikes would have prevented any of this happening. I don't really understand the causal mechanism by which the airstrikes that were proposed would really have stopped Assad's resolve. But certainly the fact that there's been so little, that the situation's only been deteriorating for 3 years now, is kind of breeding all sorts of vicious circles. And it was predictable there was going to be a huge rise in anti-Western sentiment because the West promised so much to the opposition and delivered very, very little indeed.
I mean, you know, at the risk of tempting fate, it's not easy to imagine that this could be any worse than it is it?
Well, I suppose it's just about possible to believe that you could have had even more refugees, that there could have been even more violence. You could, in some ways, you could look at it and say, well, at least somebody is marginally in charge, even if it's Assad. If you look across to other places, including Iraq, that isn't entirely clear. So, yes, I suppose it could get worse. As for whether airstrikes could have stopped any of this, I think if we look back a year, certainly some of the responses I've had, say from Russians, has been to say, well, it wasn't a matter of airstrikes this time last year. You Westerners were actually making completely the wrong choice. We advised you that you risked getting into bed with people like Islamic State. That was our worry. This is why we opposed getting involved, and you didn't listen to us. And now it's come back to haunt you a year later.
You mentioned the airstrikes, and over the last few days there's been various reports saying that the United States, which has been striking Islamic State targets in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government, such as it is also considering hitting Islamic State targets inside Syria. Jane, I'll ask you first, does it make any sense not to? Because obviously that is the Islamic State's base. Even if you could bomb them out of Iraq, which is a debatable proposition while they hold cities the size of Mosul, you have to hit them in Syria if you're serious, don't you? And you've got the language someone like US Secretary of State John Kerry has been using, saying Islamic State must be destroyed.
It makes sense there needs to be a joined-up strategy for Syria and Iraq, but the big problem here, of course, is that the US risks looking like it's on the same side as Assad. There were already reports from the BBC that when the airstrikes in Iraq started, Assad was carrying out airstrikes in Syria at the same time, in a rather crude attempt to show that he and the US were on the same side. But it is vitally important here to look at why this extreme radicalisation has happened. It has included the fact that when the uprising started in Syria, Assad let a lot of violent Islamists out of prison. He pursued a strategy of sectarian violence, which was bound to bring about revenge.
That point is obviously a tricky one, the one about acting in a way in Syria which could conceivably redound to Assad's advantage. How big a worry is that, Mary, that if the US involves itself in Syria, it ends up looking like, or indeed being, effectively Bashar al-Assad's air force?
Yes, I mean, that is a huge risk. And I think that the Americans, and Obama in particular, will be concerned to limit any strikes that they decide on to areas that are seen and understood to be outside Assad's control. Nonetheless, anything they do strike and any damage, any casualties that they cause will be seen as operating from the other side. So I think, yes, that's a risk. I mean, it may be a risk that Obama and the White House believes is actually worth taking.
Because the thing is, as well, I guess, if you're going to get really cynical about it, indisputably awful though Assad is, and awful in many respects though his rule was, I don't think there's many people who wouldn't sign up for what Syria used to be like in 2010 at this point, is there?
I think that's true. I think there's many people who were leaders of the uprising who would prefer to go back to 2010, but I think it is vitally important to recognise that much of this violence has come from the regime, sectarian killings, use of chemical weapons against civilians. So maybe 2010 was better, but that doesn't mean that Assad is an anti-terror saviour. He's actually created a lot of this problem in the first place. But I think many people are forgetting that now.
Is there a role that other Arab countries could be playing here? Because when people talk about intervention and something must be done, the people who it comes down to do that, it tends to be the United States, the United Kingdom, and the wider NATO alliance. Mm-hmm. Is there something Arab countries should be doing, and why aren't they?
Well, the Gulf has been very involved, of course, in funding the Syrian opposition. And there's a lot of accusations that some private money from the Gulf has gone to jihadi-type fighters of the Islamic State and al-Nusra or al-Qaeda type. The Gulf countries obviously deny that, but it is a really big worry. What could they do next? Well, there are these reports that we'll no doubt discuss later about the UAE and Egypt apparently bombing Islamists in Libya. That was spectacularly unsuccessful. I'm not convinced US airstrikes are the answer, and I think adventurous airstrikes by other Arab countries would face an even larger backlash.
We will get shortly to Libya, but just finally on this one, Mary, is that where we are with Syria now, that either the Western world resigns itself to trying to do something militarily, or we just decide that we are going to let whatever is going to happen happen?
I get the very strong impression that there's really been decided, as you say, a let what's going to happen happen, because almost any of the alternatives are actually worse.
Well, we're going to take a short break now on that happy thought. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, with The Independent's Mary Dajewski and Chatham House's Jane Kinnamont. When we return, we'll be looking at the Middle East and North Africa.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day, there's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. It's coming up for 1821 in London. Still with me are Mary Dajewski from The Independent and Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House. Let's look now at Libya, where yesterday's resignation of the government came as a severe shock to millions of Libyans surprised to learn that they had one. Prime Minister Abdullah Al-Tini says that this will enable the parliament elected in June, as opposed to the parliament that was already there and thinks it still is, to form a new and more inclusive government. Jane, I'll ask you first. How optimistic is the outgoing Prime Minister being here about assembling a new national unity government when they can't even set foot in their own capital?
Well, just 2 days ago, that parliament had issued a decree that all militias in Libya would be disarmed and disbanded.
How's that working
out? Just before, that is, the 2 days before they took Tripoli Airport. I mean, the relevance is very limited. It should be said, of course, that Libyans voted for this government. They didn't vote for the Islamists. The Islamists have lost both sets of elections. But because the government does not have the control over the use of force, its ability to implement its will is extremely, extremely limited.
Mary, this looks remarkably like a civil war at this point, doesn't it? We have two rival parliaments, one of which can't set foot in its own capital. They're both backed by armed factions. There's sort of various regional and sectarian splits within the country. It doesn't look terribly encouraging, does it?
It doesn't look encouraging. I mean, I would stop short of calling it a civil war at this stage. I think maybe there's a slight possibility that can be fended off. But I think what it is, among so many other things, is it's a graphic demonstration of how calls for unity and effective government are actually extremely difficult in countries like Libya, not just Libya, but like Iraq and like Afghanistan. We say we call for elections, and then when they have those elections and they prove hugely divisive and nobody can actually form a government or a government that stays, then we turn around and we say, make a government of national unity. And there is no way that this is going to happen, because the election, among everything else, has actually served to fragment things. So I think there's a lot of counterproductive reasoning here.
We talked earlier about the fact that there have been a series over the last week of air raids on Islamist positions in Libya. As far as anybody is able to figure out, these appear to have been UAE aircraft and UAE pilots flying out of Egypt. Jane, why are they doing this? What is going on here? If that's actually what's going on, and there does seem to be some dispute about that, but if that is what is happening, why would they be doing that?
The UAE feels that the US hasn't taken the Islamist threat seriously enough. So this is quite interesting. For a lot of the last decade, many Muslims felt the US was generalising too much about Muslims, but some secular forces in the Muslim world, including the UAE and the Egyptian governments, do it even more so. They don't believe that there are moderate versus radical Islamists. They think that all Islamists are a massive threat. And so this seems to be partly a show of force directed at the Islamists, but also directed at the US. And interestingly, directed at Qatar, the UAE's neighbour. The UAE is very angry because they feel that Qatar is funding all sorts of Islamist groups around the region and possibly even funding some in the UAE.
The UAE and Egypt, of course, do have a dislike of Qatar very much in common, something which we'll be coming to again shortly. Mary, does this sound like the sort of thing that might be going on? Because there has been a series of bizarre air war eruptions in Libya over the last few weeks. There was a series of air raids conducted at one point by an Air Force general who appeared to be freelancing with half of the Libyan Air Force, which he'd sort of acquired somehow as his own personal fiefdom. Does that analysis stand up? Do you think are the UAE trying to send a message to Qatar by bombing Libya?
Well, I mean, I bow to Jane's superior expertise in this because I don't know, except that when I heard that news about UAE and Egypt somehow colluding to bomb Libya, you sort of stopped and thought, well, you know, this is a departure from everything that we've heard before. Mm. What is, and I had the same question that you had, what on earth is going on here? I mean, it simply seemed to add to the complexity that there was now outside engagement from somebody who wasn't the people who'd been outside engaging before, which was the British and the Americans and the French.
The British and the Americans and the French rather hilariously have reacted to this by saying, you know, outside interference in Libyan affairs should be avoided at all costs.
I'm I enjoyed that too.
I'm not quite sure how short they think everybody's memories are. But is there a constructive role here for outside powers, Jane, or is Libya either just going to have to sort itself out or not, as the case may be?
I mean, that aforementioned Libyan parliament, which was elected, called for the UN to intervene and protect civilians in Libya. But I don't see much appetite for that, especially when you look at the sheer number of different militias that there are. You're talking about maybe 400 different militias. How do you begin to sort of fight something like that? There might be room for international help on trying to get a really serious program of disarmament going. Libya does have a lot of oil resources, much of which are still in the state oil company's control, which could maybe be used to, let's face it, bribe people out of their militias. But I don't think we are going to see a repeat of military intervention in Libya anytime soon.
Well, let's move finally to Egypt, where former President Mohamed Morsi faces a lengthening of his charge sheet. He's already on trial for conspiring with foreign terrorists, plotting a prison break, inciting murder, and whatever else prosecutors thought seemed like a good idea at the time. He now faces investigation for passing secret files to Qatar, and in a clangingly obvious bid to shore up Egypt's absurd imprisonment of three Al Jazeera reporters, Al Jazeera is cited as the intermediary. Mary, is there any imaginable reason why a country's president would be passing national security documents about his own country to a foreign news network?
Well, I suppose at the extreme, if he felt that coverage at home was extremely hostile and that he could somehow drum up, give some authenticity, some credibility to reports coming from elsewhere. But it does look like, given the length, as you say, of the charge sheet already, they really don't need any more to throw at Morsi. So this, as you say, it looks as though it's connected with the whole Al Jazeera affair, which, I mean, also I have a slightly sort of extra take on, which I think that the Western journalist establishment, which is always so quick to defend the reputations of their colleagues around the world, has really been quite negligent in the matter of the Al Jazeera journalists in Egypt. I think they've had scandalously little support for extraordinarily long prison sentences on completely trumped up charges. And I'm sorry that the support hasn't been greater.
On the subject of completely trumped up charges, I mean, as Mary points out, it does seem silly to pile yet more charges on Mohamed Morsi. I think there's obviously very little doubt about which way this trial is heading. Is this just Egypt taking another swipe at Qatar because they can?
I think that's basically the case. I mean, ironically, under Mubarak, there was intelligence cooperation between Egypt and Qatar, as well as between Egypt and the other Gulf states. Intelligence cooperation goes on all the time, but there is a deep paranoia about Qatar at the moment. They may be trying to send a message to it not to try to interfere in any way in the future.
I'm also wondering just about Mubarak, how difficult an issue this is going to be for Egypt, because presumably once they've, you know, finished the fair trial of him and he'll be found guilty of everything, what do you actually do with him?
I think Morsi is very likely to just stay in prison in Egypt. There might be some attempt by European diplomats to find a way of getting him outside the country and into asylum. But, you know, there aren't many, well, there aren't many alive former presidents in the Arab world, and there certainly aren't many of them wandering around free.
The retirement options are generally limited. Mary, is there any reason at all, do you think, to take Mohamed Morsi's trial any more seriously than we were?
Not much, no. I mean, it looks like from the start that it was a hugely political and opportunist attempt to basically take him out of circulation permanently. And I think that is, you know, that reflects extremely badly on the current regime in Egypt, which, of course, you know, doesn't have a huge amount going for it. But the idea that instead, not simply removing your chief political opponents, but actually neutralizing them and taking them completely out of the scene altogether by putting them on trial on trumped-up charges, carting them off to prison immediately. You know, that's just the resort of weak governments who simply want to illustrate their power, and it's certainly nothing to do with rule of law or any sort of civilized values.
Okay, well, at the end of half an hour that succeeded making everybody thoroughly nostalgic for Mubarak, Gaddafi and Assad, we will have to leave it there. Jane Kinnon-Mott and Mary Dujewski, thank you both very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And there's plenty coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll hear from our woman in Bogota. We'll find out what happens when you've got a whole pile of somebody else's gold and you don't know where to send it back. And we'll be reviewing the week's cinema releases. But before we get started on all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the world news headlines.
Thank you very much. Ukraine has today called for full membership of NATO, its strongest plea yet for Western military help, after accusing Russia of sending in armoured columns that have routed its troops on behalf of pro-Moscow rebels. Senegal has become West Africa's fifth country to confirm a case of Ebola on Friday after a student arrived from neighbouring Guinea carrying the disease. Brazil's GDP fell 0.6% in the second quarter this year, reported National Statistics Agency today. The news means that the country suffered a recession in the first half of the year as investment plunged and the country's hosting of the World Cup suffocated economic activity. And here, the British Prime Minister has claimed much of Scottish industry and more than a million jobs could be in jeopardy if the country votes next month to leave the United Kingdom. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It is 21:32 in Moscow. That's 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we're heading to Colombia, from where I'm joined by Anastasia Maloney. Anastasia, welcome to the show. Some good news first, which is that Colombia's economy is a good news story.
That's right. Compared to what the Brazil economy is going through in its recession, Colombia actually has some good news. The Colombian government announced this week that the economy would grow by 5% this year, and much of that is because of construction boom. A lot of new houses are being built by the government, particularly for low-income families, and the government's also pushing ahead with big infrastructure projects. Such as the building of roads and expansion of ports and airports. So Colombia definitely is experiencing good economic growth this year, as it has been for the last couple of years.
And Colombia must, of course, be especially delighted by comparisons with Brazil's relative sluggishness. But is it possible to distill what it is that Colombia is doing right that Brazil is doing wrong or isn't doing at all?
Many people say that actually Colombia's finance ministers have actually done a really good job of managing inflation and keeping the economy on the right direction. They've had a string of excellent finance ministers. That's one reason why Colombia's economy, people say, is in good shape. The other is because security has improved in Colombia in the last over the past decade, and that's meant a lot of new foreign investment coming to the country, particularly in oil and gas exploration, coal and minerals. And so that's really also boosted economic growth in the past few years.
You talk there about security improving, of course, and that is rising from a very, very low base. But one of the reasons behind that, of course, is that Colombia is no longer in quite the state of civil war that it has been for a lot of the last decades. And that is, of course, due to the ongoing peace talks between the Colombian government and FARC. which do almost now seem like they've been going on longer than the war did, but there has been some progress.
Yes, I think this month has been really pivotal and really important because, as you say, they've been going on for now almost 2 years, but this month was a bit of a breakthrough. Firstly, there was a delegation of 10 victims that travelled to Havana to meet face-to-face with the FARC commanders to tell them how they had suffered during the war, all their relatives who had been killed and displaced or gone missing. This is really important because it's the first time that Colombia's war victims actually have a seat at the negotiating table and their voices can be heard. But perhaps even more significantly, last week, a delegation of very high-ranking military officers and members of the armed forces who are active, who are actually fighting the FARC as we speak now in Colombia, went to Havana to, again, meet with FARC commanders. And that's the first time in any peace negotiations that's been taking place in Colombia where active military officers have sat down at the same table with the FARC. And people say that's a sign that the two sides are really ready now to seriously talk about a possible ceasefire in the future and the process of the FARC handing in their weapons and how they would demobilize if a peace deal was signed.
Is there any sense yet, or am I getting way ahead of myself here, in asking if there's any idea about a time frame by which you might actually see people sitting down at a table signing things and shaking hands in front of cameras?
Yeah, well, that's the big question. And I think most people would say that that's still very far off still. There's months and months to go to sort out the questions that I've just been talking about, particularly how the FARC would hand in their weapons, who would verify that process, and whether a ceasefire, if it did take place, would actually be long-lasting. So experts here, the most hopeful ones, optimistic about the peace process, would say at least another 6 months. However, the president has always been cautiously optimistic and has always been pushing for a quicker end to the peace deal. And he's always said that, you know, as long as there's goodwill on both sides, a peace deal could in fact happen by the end of the year. But that's looking very unlikely.
And finally, a story which I guess is kind of a reminder of the bad old days that those peace talks are supposed to put Colombia ahead of or put behind. Anyway, you know what I'm saying. It begs rather the question of how many years you should serve in jail for killing 300 people.
Oh, that's right. This is still a major talking point in Colombia, and it's to do with probably the most notorious hitman of Pablo Escobar, John Velasquez, who's known as Popeye, or Popeye. And he was released on Wednesday after serving 22 years of a 30-year prison sentence. And he had confessed to killing up to 300 people, and also he had a hand in thousands of other killings and murders of people in Colombia during the 1980s and 1990s. And he was definitely known as the right-hand man of Pablo Escobar, who died at the hands of the police. And people are saying, well, you know, he's confessed to 300 murders. Is 22 years really enough? Some are saying, yes, he's paid his crimes and he's confessed. Others are saying that's nowhere near enough for a serial killer as he was. He was released, and people are saying whether or not the Colombian government should in fact provide him security and bodyguards, because apparently he has a price on his head. He's made many enemies over the last few years. And also whether in fact he does know about secret boxes of money that Pablo Escobar apparently left in certain homes and country estates across Colombia. Does he know about those? And is he going to go after that money and start digging for it? So there's still very many questions raised about his release and whether or not he's still going to be an important player in Colombia.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up next, the curious case of Crimea's gold. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House on Monocle 24.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24, broadcasting from Midori House at 1 Dorset Street, London, W1. Monocle 24 is a wholly owned subsidiary of Wynn Content, and is edited by Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck. With bureaus in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and New York, Monocle 24 has over 50 editors and correspondents filing for us around the clock. If you have any editorial, distribution or advertising queries, please email us at info@monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's 1840 here in London. Now, an unlikely new front has opened in the pseudo-war between Russia and Ukraine, an art gallery in Amsterdam. Back in February, the University of Amsterdam's Allard Pearson Museum opened an exhibition called The Crimea, Gold and Secrets of the Black Sea. Among the archaeological prizes including in the exhibition were gold helmets, priceless jewellery and coins dating back to the rule of ancient Greece. The exhibition closed in June, but the exhibits are still in Holland, as nobody quite knows where to send them back to. In February, the Crimean museums which lent the pieces were in Ukraine. Now they're sort of in Russia. Joining us now from our New York bureau is Javier Pez, who's the deputy editor of the Art newspaper. Javier, I'll ask the big obvious question first, and then we'll try and figure it out from there. Who owns these things now?
Well, they're at the centre of a custody battle, and so no one really knows. It's really in the hands of, lawyers / diplomats.
Why wouldn't it just be a case of returning them to the museums that they came from, whichever country those museums now happen to be in?
Well, the added complicating factor is, I think it's three or four of the museums are in the Crimean Peninsula, which was the Ukraine when they left, but is now part of Mother Russia. But some of the objects actually came from a museum which is still in Ukraine.
Is there a sort of established legal framework for sorting things like this out? Is there a kind of arbitrator who deals with ownership of art or something?
No. Should it be so simple? No, there are custody battles, and there are also stranded objects in the past, but they're kind of each has to be kind of argued out. This one is obviously, because there's an ongoing conflict, I imagine we'll wait, hopefully soon the dust will settle and shelling stopped, because it sounds like the sort of, when you listen to what both sides are saying, really, no one wants to kind of escalate this one any more than it is.
What is the likely next step in a custody dispute, as you put it like this?
I think time. It's obviously dependent on events in the kind of political and military events, and I imagine that there are conversations going on behind the scenes, looking to try and come to a kind of a settlement over this.
Javier Pez from the Art newspaper, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Time now for a bit of music. This is The Drifters.
Well, Saturday night at 8 o'clock, I know where I'm gonna go. I'm gonna pick my baby up and take her to the picture show. When you're with your baby,
The Drifters with Saturday Night at the Movies, and we will be this Friday night, such as is, talking about the upcoming new releases fairly shortly before the end of the show. Before that, however, a preview of this week's edition of The Menu, which focuses on the MAD Symposium in Copenhagen, which brought together the world's leading chefs, restaurateurs and producers and thinkers from the world of food. One of the people there representing food writing was Anja von Bremsen, who is placed amongst the world's most successful food writers, having won 3 James Beard Awards. Born in what was then the USSR, she has written about Soviet food culture, brave lady, but at MAD, she talked about her most memorable food experiences and where she thinks the business is going.
Well, I actually talked about my childhood in the USSR, when food was had almost like this existential metaphoric meaning. So I was talking about what food can represent on almost a higher level, what imagination can do. And I also spoke about what is cooking from the perspective of the diner. Because we heard so much from chefs who have dreams, who have visions that they want to impose on the diners. But sometimes they forget that we, you know, the pesky guests actually exist.
What do you think of this kind of an event? I think it's interesting that there are so many of world's top chefs getting together. And you actually are here witnessing that they actually are friends and they kind of keep it together.
It's an amazing generation and it's an amazing relationship that they have formed through various events like Cook at Raw, Galinas. You know, they've known each other for a long time. They come together to cook and they really want to be with each other. And it's amazing to see Alex Atala, René Redzepi, David Chang, you know, clearing each other's plates, so to speak, or, you know, putting finishing touches on the other's dishes. You know, the older French generation, the Nouvelle Cuisine generation, it was all about ego. They made kind of formations, you know, the group of 8, whatever, and then they fell apart, you know. Recipes were jealously guarded. But it was Ferran Adrià, actually, who introduced the spirit of sharing by, you know, just putting everything he was doing, all his crazy experiments, online for everyone to access for free. And I think this is continued by the next generation. It's really beautiful to see.
So what are the defining characteristics of this generation? You're comparing this generation to the previous one. Obviously, they are keeping it together a bit more, but how otherwise do they differ from the chefs we saw a few decades ago?
Well, there were the French chefs, and then Ferran Adrià came along and introduced science, technique, a whole completely new vision, and a lot of these guys actually trained with him or staged with him. And the post-Adrià generation, a lot of them are returning to nature, such as René Redzepi, Alex Atala, also returning to nature, exploring, you know, the nature of, you know, his Brazilian terroir. They're more terroir-driven. They have all the technical knowledge that they got from Adrià, and now they're using it to explore, you know, their natural life.
I was listening to your speech yesterday and there were some things that actually really made me think. One of them was that you were kind of touching the topic of how fine dining is doing nowadays.
Fine dining is in a difficult place. The guests are defecting because it's much easier to get something at a taco truck or a cheap bistro. The whole food truck movement is incredible because, you know, it has social significance as well. Fine dining requires a lot of your time, a lot of commitment. You have to sit there for 4 hours, taste the degustation menu. And I think we're lucky to have these guys, you know, again, Alex Atala, René Redzepi. They are so dynamic and they're so attractive and they get set such an example that, you know, younger chefs are gravitating towards them. And the diners, like, you know, René is the best restaurant in the world. And also they have the means and they have the willpower and they have the energy to keep, you know, creative laboratories. You know, René Redzepi, for instance, is working on fermentation. It's a very seer. They have a lab. They have a PhD scientist working with them. And, you know, fine dining restaurants act as laboratories from which ideas and technique trickles down to the more casual restaurants. So we need to preserve the fine dining, but without the pomp and the ritual and the boredom that sometimes it can accompany.
You obviously appreciate a lot the work, say, Noma is doing when we talk about Nordic Food Lab and so forth. Where do you think this all is going to? What are the innovations we see now that are most important and what kind of innovations do you expect to see in the future?
It's hard to tell. Everyone is working on a different thing. I mean, for instance, Alex Atala from Brazil, from Dom, he opened up a whole new landscape of Amazonian products. And, you know, therefore he empowered Brazilian, young Brazilian chefs to be proud of their cuisine. René has done the same for Nordic cuisine. It was a very impoverished cuisine. It was a bleak landscape. You know, nothing grew here in winter. But he found great beauty and poetry in the few ingredients. What we're seeing all around the world, you know, are kind of imitations of René Redzepi's plating. You know, we see the charred onions, the smoked bone marrow, you know, the certain flowers, you know, dishes decorated with flowers. What we don't see is the essence I mean, I think fermentation is right now in the air. You know, this Korean-American chef David Chang talked about it. Bacteria is actually what's in fashion, because everything around us is actually fermented. And understanding how these processes work, I think this is a lot of what the chefs are working with. It doesn't sound glamorous, but it is actually essential.
What does that actually mean in real life? When am I going to go to a restaurant where the chef has been using bacteria in order to achieve something?
Well, you just ate bread, you're drinking beer, it's all fermented. Everything is fermented, so you just don't realize it. You know, how do you make a perfect bread? Well, you have to understand fermentation. How do you make a perfect pickle? Well, you have to understand fermentation. The way these chefs use it, I mean, first of all, they understand the basic processes that go on in the things that you see every day. You know, the croissant, everything around you essentially has the fermentation bacteria. So it's not like this bacteria is crawling around you. Think of miso, you know, anything you eat in the Japanese kitchen, soy sauce, that's all fermented.
Anja von Bremsen talking there to our Marcus Hippe, and you can hear more of that and more things about food in about 8 minutes from now on this week's edition of The Menu at 1900 London time on Monocle 24. And don't forget that you can always catch up with things on our website. And it is now, as promised earlier, the proverbial Friday night at the movies, though that's not actually proverbial. That's kind of a bastardization of a well-known song title. You are listening to Midori House. It is time for our weekly film review, and we are joined once again by Karen Krasanovich. Karen, welcome back to the programme. Where did you want to start this week?
Well, I think we should start with the big film,
okay.
which is an American young adult drama called If I Stay. Now, it stars the omnipresent Chloe Grace Moretz. You remember her from Kick-Ass, Kick-Ass 2. It is based on Gail Forman's best-selling YA novel of the same name. And basically, it's directed by R.J. Cutler, who did the September issue, which was a documentary. So this is quite interesting. It's the story of a young girl and her family. It's a snow day. They go out for a drive, and there's a car accident. I don't want to say exactly what happens, but she ends up in a coma, having an out-of-body experience, talking to her own self and revisiting her life in flashbacks while she decides whether she's going to live or die.
Okay, it's not an altogether unheard of concept. Similar things have been done. Do they make a go of it?
Well, they make a good go of it, I have to say. Although her running down the hallway, and she obviously can't open any doors or anything, so it's kind of a ghostly element going on there.
It is one of the tricky bits about being a ghost.
Yeah, and all I could think of was that, well, she must be wearing that dress for how many days now? But no, it's only one day, actually. But one of the really good things about this is that, okay, number one, it is a tear machine. Even if you're rough and tough like you, Andrew, it's you're going to need a little something to dab your eyes. But they really do conjure up kind of the ideal young love, because there is a lot of ideal love. She doesn't drink. She plays the cello. Her boyfriend drinks. He plays the guitar. They'll never get together, right?
Okay, well, let's see if we can maintain our composure through a brief extract.
Isn't it amazing how life is one thing and then in an instant it becomes something else? Like here I am, Mia, the girl who thinks about the cello and Adam, and just like that.
Here's the secret, baby. If you live, if you die, it's all up to you. So whatever fight you got in you, you gotta pull it out now.
I don't know. I'm okay.
Really?
Yeah. I saw
a little glint there, little glossiness in the eye there. That was the nurse saying, "Hey, baby, hang on in there." Jamie Blackley, who plays her boyfriend, is going to be in the new Woody Allen movie. So if you see this, it's not, you know, you could go and see it for that reason. Also, there's a chap in there called Joshua Leonard. He was in the Blair Witch Project. He's a filmmaker, and he was really good as her ex-rocker dad. He was really good.
Okay, I want to move on to a It's kind of, well, it is a biopic, I guess. This is of Aaron Swartz, the so-called hacktivist who killed himself last year. This is a very quickly put together film, then. Does it look like a quickly put together film?
Well, I mean, not really. I mean, it's traditional in its structure. It starts out with Aaron Swartz's parents showing pictures, because of course we're in a digital age, so you know it's not unusual to have lots and lots of
indeed,
you know, footage of your children. So we go through his career, and he killed himself at 26. He was immediately, he was gifted, he was a genius, and he became very, very concerned with people's civil rights online, and fought SOPA, and was really very forward-thinking, and stuck his neck out there. But he was eventually, from we take the angle of this documentary, hounded basically to suicide.
The film is called The Internet's Own Boy. Here is an excerpt.
Aaron was trying to make the world work. He was trying to fix it.
Bringing public access to the public domain.
He doesn't hack JSTOR in the traditional sense of hacking.
He wasn't stealing, he was making a point.
They arrested him, strip searched him, and left him in solitary confinement.
And he said, they want to make an example out of me.
It sounded like it had exactly the same soundtrack to If I Stay. There is clearly a lot of work out there for cellists at the moment.
It's 2014 is the year of the cello. I forgot to tell you that. Tim Berners-Lee does some talking head work in this, and he's fascinating. It's a very, very interesting film, particularly if you're involved with Anonymous or you're interested in any kind of hacking, quote unquote, my fingers are in the air stories. It's very interesting, and it's an angry film. It is.
Okay, and I want to touch finally, and unfortunately quite briefly, on As Above, So Below, a kind of archaeological adventure yarn.
It's got a great trailer. It's all I can say. I was so excited when the trailer. This is American horror set in the Paris catacombs, or catacombs. I don't know how to say it. It looked so amazing, but basically, do we have a clip of it?
We probably don't have time to play it, unfortunately.
Okay. Anyway, it's crazy. And if there was a drinking game, one of the reviewers said if there was a drinking game where the camera stayed steady, nobody'd have a drink.
Oh, it's got that kind of found footage. That just makes me seasick.
I know, it does a little bit. Like you'd put a little, you know, put a camera on top of a Labrador, put him down in the catacombs.
Karen Krasanovich, with that's a review they're not putting on the posters. Karen Krasanovich, thank you very much for joining us. That is As Above, So Below. And that is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks to our earlier guests, Jane Kinnan-Mont and Mary Dajewski. Today's show was produced by Isabel Kaiser and Marcus Hippie, research by David Pleasant and Rebecca Unger. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Jonathan Wheatley returns after this with the headlines. The Menu is at 1900. The Monocle Daily with me and Emma Nelson is at 2200. And this show returns at the same time on Monday. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.